looking behind you, and do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains, lest you be swept away. But Lot, of course, a stupid believer that he is, has to argue with the angels who are there to save him. Oh no, my lords. And actually, it's my lord, singular. Behold, your servant has found favor in your sight. Let me go over here to this little town. So, Lot the idiot, anyway, still does it. So, God here, it's continuing upon his righteousness, and the issue gets into God's righteousness and how and when and why he shows mercy. Gee, therefore, while God always possesses the attribute of love from which his mercy flows, he obviously restricts the expression of mercy as his righteousness demands. H, to accuse God of being uncaring or indifferent to sorrow, and that's what most people do, particularly people that are negative, they want to accuse God of being horrible in all of this. So to accuse him of being uncaring or indifferent to sorrow or suffering demonstrates a complete lack of understanding of the makeup and function of the divine essence, and is blasphemous as well. John 3:16 we would cite, which demonstrates the depth of God's love, the lengths to which he will go in order to provide salvation for mankind at the expense of his very own son. And that verse has a lot of principles that can be drawn off of it, but one is the obvious depth and of God's compassion and mercy and all of that is manifested by the fact that he sacrificed that which was closest to him, we might say. Five here, situations which clearly demand emotional toughness. A, since God should be our standard for expression of mercy, and God himself must, at times, limit or restrict the expression of mercy, it should come as no surprise that his children will have to do likewise. Matthew 10, 24 and 25. So there's going to be times when you just have to be tough with people. That's just all there is to it. And you say, well, I don't like being tough with people. Well, you weren't asked. I would assume, if I know anything about the essence of God, that he likes to show mercy all the time and that he likes being compassionate. But he doesn't. Matthew 10, 24, a disciple is not above his teacher, nor a slave above his master. It is enough for the disciple that he become as his teacher and the slave as his master. So if they've called the head of the house Beelzebul, this is a principle of they're going to attack you because they've attacked me. But the principle also can be taken to, if God has to be tough sometimes, so do we. B, certain situations demand that the normal human expressions of compassion and mercy be suppressed in order to achieve a greater goal. C, the believer who seeks to orient only to God's love and not his righteousness will constantly be off balance emotionally and make bad decisions as to how to conduct himself and how to handle certain situations. D, for instance, the believer who is called upon to engage in warfare must put aside any feelings of compassion and mercy and destroy the enemy. Now, I don't know how they fight wars nowadays, but the last time I checked, we do know how they fight wars nowadays. The last time I checked, the goal of a war was to win. I've always thought the goal of sporting events was to win. You know, I think the goal of playing Monopoly is to win, isn't it? I think if you want to play that game for all those hours, you might as well at least win. Deuteronomy 7:16, and you shall consume all the peoples whom the Lord your God will deliver you. Your eyes shall not pity them, neither shall you serve their gods, for that would be a snare to you. And one of the dangers is that you get involved emotionally with people who are negative and people who are seriously negative. And you get emotionally involved with these people, and so this is one of the reasons here, the command not to show pity at all, not to even think about it, because one of the dangers is the doctrine of separation is the next thing that takes it. And so you get involved emotionally with somebody who's negative, you may not be able to make the proper doctrinal application after that. So there, their command is strictly, you know, you go in there and you slaughter these people, and you do it just like I've told you. 1 Samuel 15, now this deals with the final manifestation of the negative volition of Saul that got him ultimately checked out under the sin unto death. 1 Samuel 15, 2 and 3, thus says the Lord of the armies, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he set himself against him on the way while he was coming up from Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and utterly destroy all that he has. and do not spare him, but put to death both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. Obviously, I mean, the goal here is there is to be no survivors. You walk in there, when you go into these people, don't worry about the little baby that's crying, kill it. Now, that sounds pretty harsh. But, obviously, one of the things, and I don't want to stop and go off on all this, but you got to recognize that Amalek was the shepherd kings. They're known in history as the Hyksos. And they were a disgusting set of people. They were bad news all the time. Matter of fact, when Amalek was moving into Egypt as the Jews were moving out there at the Exodus, and the Hyksos, they understand, even Egyptian historians will tell you, this was a worthless people. That during their period of history when they were dominant, and this basically is in effect, Saul is killing the Hyksos, the Amalekites, and basically going to restore Egypt to Egypt. And so he's doing them a huge favor, obviously, but if you go in and you study Egyptology and you check out their history, you'll find out that it's very evident that this was a worthless people. They didn't do any building, they didn't do any construction, they didn't do anything to distinguish themselves in any way. Israel or Egypt was in a period of horrible decline under their leadership. And they were obviously very evil people to boot, on top of all the fact that they just weren't, you know, what we might call quality people. They were very evil. So one, those that fail to do so will likely become casualties themselves. So if you're told to kill somebody, you better kill them. And obviously we're not in the age of Israel and we don't have to do all this now. We're not going to be put under this gun, but believers in history have. Those in the establishment chain of command must suppress any feelings of compassion and mercy when executing justice on the criminal element of society. Deuteronomy 19. And that's one of the difficult things. Being a judge, in my opinion, would be a pretty tough row to hoe. Because you're making decisions. You've got to balance two things. You've got to balance the good of society and all the laws that we have. And we have laws for a reason. And these are to be enforced. And then you have to balance that with some element of understanding of each case before you, who's involved in it and what all is involved. I mean, you really don't want a judge that doesn't consider anything other than the law, do you? Because if you get a judge, you just can and be careful what you wish for, because you may end up standing before a judge someday. And you may want some mercy and compassion when you're standing there before the judge and he's making decisions about your future. Well, I want the judge to take into account the laws, obviously. We have to have that. But obviously, we also want the judge to consider other factors as well. And so Deuteronomy 19, again, that's a pretty tough deal because you have to deal. Now, obviously, in an easy case like murder, that's a simple one. We know that murderers should die. They violated divine institution number one, volition. Therefore, they'd lose the right to their volition. They lose the right to live. But if there is a man who hates his neighbor and lies in wait for him, and rises up against him and strikes him so that he dies, and he flees to one of these cities. These are the cities of refuge, by the way. Because you understand, and even in our law, there's a distinction made between murder and manslaughter. You might accidentally sometime kill somebody. I mean, you're not going to feel good about it. Even if you accidentally kill them, you won't feel good about it. But should the person who accidentally kills somebody be treated as the same way a person who intentionally kills somebody? And the answer is no. And the law covered a lot of these contingencies in here of what constituted what. But if a person was simply accidentally killed somebody, now that's seen, for instance, in verse 4. Now this is the case of the manslayer, who may flee there and live, when he kills his friend unintentionally, not hating him previously. So some of it gets into the mental attitude. If you're committing a crime, and you've got a bad mental attitude, and that constitutes murder. Now this, if a man goes into the forest with his friend to cut wood, and his hand swings the axe to cut the tree, and the iron head slips off the handle and strikes his friend so that he dies, he may flee to one of these cities and live. And so God's will for him was not to kill the manslayer. That was an accident. You don't put people in jail or prison or kill them for accidents. And so the reality is you have to have what we call, obviously, in order to constitute murder, you have to have a motive. And that gets into the mental attitude. So, but if a man commits murder, as per verse 11, then the elders of the city shall send and take him from there and deliver him into the hand of the avenger of blood so that he may die. You will not pity him, but you shall purge the blood of the innocent from Israel, that it may go well with you. So there, obviously, one, and in fact, this is the essence of the civil code, without which one cannot have a safe and healthy society. Deuteronomy 19:21, and thus you shall not show pity. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. And as long as you understand that that's the civil code, that is the law, we might say, of the land. That's not what God demands in every situation. He's talking about from a legal aspect, that there is to be adequate, and we call it the law of lex talionis, adequate and equal retribution. Whatever you do, if you go out and kill somebody, you better recognize you deserve to die. And that's for the civil code. And without that, society would be, it's as bad as it is now. Think of what it would be like without any laws or any deterrence to crime. F, parents must set aside their normal feelings of love, mercy, and compassion and administer consistent discipline to effectively discipline and instruct the child. Proverbs 23:13-14. Because as we understand, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. Children aren't naturally smart, they're naturally stupid. And they learn and grow by, sometimes, in many cases, the hard way. And unfortunately, and of course, if we didn't learn stuff the hard way, some of us wouldn't know anything. But the fact is, you probably learned more things the hard way than you wanted to learn, maybe. So we all have done that. Well, ideally, you want to learn the easy way. There's the easy way to learn, there's the hard way to learn. And for children, unfortunately, they won't always do it the easy way. And they will push the limits. That's the nature of the STA. They try to figure out who they can get their bluff in on, what they can get away with, and all of that. So you've got to be consistent, firm, discipline them. If they commit an offense on one occasion and you discipline them, when they commit that offense again, you've got to discipline them again. You say, well, I'd be disciplining the little brat all day long. So that's your job. You're the parent. You're not here to be their friend. As that black comedian we saw said, I don't know what people are thinking. You're not here to be their friend, their buddy, their partner. You're here to be their parent. You're here to spank their butts when they need it. You're here to set an environment and a tone and an example of doctrine and discipline and instruction in the Lord that the child is expected to follow. Now, obviously, if you've got an incorrigible child and they just won't listen no matter what, well, there's only so much you can do. But the reality is that most kids will, if given discipline and boundaries and all, will honor them. Now, there's obviously that little idiot that's just going to push it. And so you drop kick them through the goalposts how many ever times you have to. And not physically, obviously. Figuratively speaking. And when you discipline the child, God made it for a place, a nice fleshy spot for him to be whipped. He didn't make them to be, you know, slap them in the face. You don't stand there and scream at them, and you look stupider than the child that's disobedient. You can't handle things because you just constantly fly off the handle. You don't punish them when you're mad. And if you do these things and apply these principles consistently, you'll find out they work. And so if you're angry, you don't punish the child. You don't whip them because you're mad. That's stupid. You're out of fellowship at that point. You aren't even doing the right thing. So the important thing is to give them that whipping when you aren't angry. And again, God made them with a place to be spanked, however you spank them. When they're little, it's nice because you can just use your hand. But then if they, you know, they get to the point where the hand doesn't affect them anymore. That's why God made wooden spoons. And then if the wooden spoon doesn't work anymore, that's when God made the belt. God made these things in this order, see? Because he knew what kids would need. And then if the bell doesn't work, he gets you a willow switch. You know what willow switch? You haven't been whipped with a willow switch? I have. I know what that's like. And yeah, it'll draw a little bit of blood. So, but you know, the little child reaches back there and comes away with a little bit of blood. He'll think long and hard before he does that again. You say, well, I don't, and I'm not saying you have. Obviously, we don't really want to beat him until there's blood. But, you know, I got switched with a willow switch, and it didn't kill me. And I never thought of calling and turning my parents in to the government. You know, first time a child threatened me with that, ooh, that'd be the end of it. You'll be looking for somewhere else to live. You better hope the government's coming, because you're going to need a place to stay. And if you think it's tough here, when do you get into the child care system? We call it child care system, you know. Tongue in cheek, because there's not much child care going on. Hey, what happened to this kid? Well, we've lost this kid. Kid was in the system. We find out we've lost him. Well, you know, got these workers filing false reports. You guys read the papers. You know. So you discipline them effectively, consistently. And the thing is, it's hard to do that because your natural deal is you love your children and you don't want to punish them. You like everything to be nice. Everybody likes it to be nice all the time. Sometimes children make it impossible to be nice. That's just the way it is. Proverbs 23, where are we at here? 13. Do not hold back discipline from the child. Although you beat him with the rod, he will not die. And obviously, you have to understand, you shouldn't have to say this, but I'll say it anyway. You shall beat him with the rod and deliver his soul from Sheol. And the point is that even a severe beating isn't going to kill a child. And obviously, as a parent, you're expected to have the sense to know the difference between punishment and abuse. You know, some people say, well, if you hit him more than 3 times, that's abuse. No, it's not. I'm just getting warmed up after this. It's easy for me now. My kids are grown. So I just stand up here and pontificate all day long. But I applied these principles. It's also easier because I can stand up here with a clear conscience knowing, oh, I did this one right. Every once in a while I get that. You know, you have those times where you're teaching and the Bible's jamming you up and you're getting nailed just like the congregation. And then there's those times where you're thinking, yeah, this was great. I did that one right. That principle I handle pretty well. So again, you have to set this aside, you know. So I'm sorry, yeah, I know you love your kids. Guess what? I love mine too. But they need spankings. They need a discipline. They did wrong things. And then when you tell them you're going to spank them, that's another whole thing. Don't threaten and not follow through. If you say you're going to do something, do it. Don't tell the child, if you do that one more time. Now, God, how many times have I heard? If you do that one more time, you're never going to get a spanking. And then they do it again. I warned you. You know. And then they don't get the spanking. That's stupid. And some kids require a lot of spanking. Some don't require as much. You've got to be, this is where you as a parent, you've got to have some doctrine, some ability to think through things, look at what you're dealing with. Even in the same family, you might have one kid that's, say, a basket case, an FCA deal, all the time. And then you might have another kid that says, you know, I don't want to go that way. So again, and generally, this is what we call a generalization. Boys are more trouble than girls. But that doesn't mean you couldn't get that horribly incorrigible little brat that's a girl. Well, if she gets lots of spanking, she gets lots of spanking. I don't care, frankly, and God doesn't care. You have to figure it out as a parent and apply all this. And apply it consistently. And it's a big job. You got these people having babies. Good grief. Do you know how much work it is to raise a kid? Well, you're going to find out. It's a lot. It's a 24/7 job. There ain't no vacations. There ain't no sick days. There ain't no time off. There is. You're on the clock for good until that child's raised. You say, well, I want to get a job where I can have some time off. Well, don't become a parent then, because you're not going to get any time off. And until that child's out of the house, they're your responsibility. And that's why you encourage them, get married as early as you can? I think they had the right idea in some of the ancient cultures. 13's plenty. Oh, no. You know? Because you're not off the clock as a parent until they're out of the house. Until they're married. And then your responsibility ends. And so, but that just means you can just turn off your love right then, right? Yeah, right. So, again, you have to, and if you don't do this, you're setting yourself up and the child for discipline from God. Like, you think God's just going to look the other way when parents just blow this off? And you can say, well, that's all right. You don't have to apply that one. Oh, no. You're under discipline, too. Gee, when it comes to dealing with religious reversionists, the believer must be absolutely unmerciful. Deuteronomy 13, 6 through 11. And well, in our society, our culture, we're loaded with religious reversionists. People who claim to speak for God, claim to be believers, and maybe they are in many cases believers. We might say they claim to be just as positive as you are, yet they're not in Bible class. They don't apply doctrine. You know, they're whatever they are. Deuteronomy 13, 6 through 11. If your brother, your mother's son, or your daughter, or your wife, who you cherish, or your friend, who is as your own soul, you got a really good second brother, entice you secretly, saying, let us go and serve other gods, whom neither you nor your fathers have known, or the gods of the peoples who are around you, near you or far from you, from one end of the earth to the other end. You shall not yield to him or listen to him, and your eyes shall not pity him, nor shall you spare or conceal him, but you shall surely kill him. Now, this was the religious law in Israel, was that God wasn't going to tolerate what we might call religious free thinkers. We got them on the day in spades. Oh, every religion's got to be respected. Who said? Bible doesn't say that. Bible doesn't say you have to respect it. I don't respect the Islamic religion. I don't respect half the fundy religions in this country. Or three-quarters of them. I don't respect the cults. I don't respect, you know, I don't respect the Hindus or the Christian Scientists or the, you know, what all they are. I don't respect any of them. I only respect people that are trying to do it right. So you shall surely kill him. Your hand shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people. So you shall stone him to death because he sought to seduce you from the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of slavery. Then all Israel will hear and be afraid. Now see, don't you know, like when I got down here, if the first person that left Bible class, we took him outside and stoned him. And I get to throw the first rock. And we killed him. Now don't you think people would rethink that? Well, obviously, we don't have that permission or motivation today to do that. But this guaranteed religious sanctity in the land. And this is one of the reasons why we don't have it. Because people are tolerant of all of this nonsense. Then all Israel will hear and be afraid. And you will never do such a wicked thing among you again. So one, this is the decisive factor to which Jesus was referring when he taught that placing family above doctrine constituted an affront to him. Matthew 10, 34 through 37. And this gets into, when you know you're dealing with religious reversionists. You know they've been exposed to the truth and they've rejected it. You know that they are negative and that they've manifested negative volition time and time and time again. And you make excuses for them. Or you socialize with them. And you go into business with them. God help you even worse. These kinds of things, this is exactly what Jesus is talking about here. 34 through 37, do not think that I came to bring peace to the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. Here a term for division. I came to set a man against his father and a daughter against her mother. And a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemy shall be the members of his own household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And that's the issue here. And this is the reason you would separate from your parents, is religious reversionism. That constitutes the bigger sin. Now here you have, again, once we might say, two apparently contradictory doctrines. You've got the honor father and mother principle, and then you've got the you better separate if they're religious reversionists. Which one takes priority? This one. This one takes priority. And always has and always will, whether people acknowledge it or not. Doesn't matter. Now, under what it does do is that makes that other one, honor father and mother, secondary to the main issue of religious sanctity and, we might say, sound doctrine. So, but then, okay, say now your mother needs money. She's a religious reversionist and all of that. Are you supposed to help her out? Yeah. Yeah, you're supposed to help her out. I wouldn't move her into my house. Anybody that does that's a moron. I wouldn't do that. You couldn't get me to do that on a bet. I mean, all my brothers have to die. That's another whole thing. That's another thing I've noticed about these idiotic religious reversionists. They want the positive believers to always take up all the slack. And yet they themselves won't lift a finger to do anything. No, move her in with you first. Then we'll see how that works out. Then you deal with it. You know, and people don't have enough cojones to step up and say, I ain't doing it. And at some point, you have to, depending upon your niche, I mean, there's a number of factors that would go into this. But if you know you're dealing with a known reversionist, somebody that's an affront to doctrine, that changes things. And whether people want to admit it changes things or not, it does. H, the pastor teacher here must suppress his normal attachment to his congregation when he is forced to use severity in dealing with various problems that arise in the course of his ministry. 2 Corinthians 12:19-21. And, you know, and everything, and this is where, you know, you got to be pretty careful. You know, the reality is, like when you're dealing with your kids, everything isn't World War III. Every little doctrinal slip-up I see doesn't demand that I get up here and pound it unmercifully. I mean, if I did that, we'd never get through the text. You know, what would we be doing all the time? Constantly dealing, running around, putting out one fire after another. Well, we're not going to do that. Let the fires burn. And if you'll figure it out. God will kick you around enough. He's kicked me around enough. I figured some things out. And so it's like you're dealing with your children. Everything isn't a spanking offense. And in a right pastor, right congregation, everything doesn't have to be dealt with. You drive your kids crazy if you do that. You drive a congregation crazy by doing that. Some things you just got to let it slide. And you know it's wrong and you know it's screwball. Guess what? I let a lot of things slide. I've seen and heard some pretty stupid stuff in the course of my ministry. I've even done some stupid stuff in the course of my ministry. But at a certain point, you just, you know, look, everything isn't World War III here. There are principles and issues that we do have to enforce. And so you have to, as a pastor, you got to be wise and pray about this. You can't just be running around dealing with every little FTA activity you see. I mean, that's not healthy. And that's really not your job. Your job is to proclaim the word. That's your number one mandate. 2 Corinthians 12:19-21. All this time you have been thinking that we are defending ourselves to you. Actually, it is in the sight of God we have been speaking in Christ, and all for your upbuilding, beloved. And I am afraid that perhaps when I come, I may find you to be not what I wish. Mm-hmm. And believe me, if I show up there and you're not what I wish, you're not going to like me. And may be found by you not to be what you wish. That perhaps there may be strife, jealousy, angry tempers, disputes, slanders, gossip, arrogance, disturbances. I am afraid that when I come again, my God may humiliate me before you. And I may mourn over many of those who have sinned in the past and have not repented of their impurity, immorality, and sensuality, which they have practiced. And also, chapter 13, verse 2, I had previously said when present the second time, and though now absent, I say in advance to all those who have sinned in the past and to the rest as well, that if I come again, I will not spare anyone. So don't think I'm going to be taking any prisoners on this deal, as Paul's telling them. And I, all believers, must put aside their care and concern for other believers when they apply various aspects of the doctrine of separation toward those that will not adhere to the straight and narrow. 1 Corinthians 5:9 and following. And again, we might say there's various aspects of, quote, the doctrine of separation. everything a believer does doesn't call for all out, I got to separate from them totally. Sometimes you just remain aloof. That doesn't mean, you know, obviously you'll talk to them. You may be cool towards them. And if people are suddenly cool towards you, you better ask yourself why. There's a reason, I'm sure. And so that doesn't call for all-out separation, though. I don't want to even be around them. But you might, you know, you pull back at a certain level. And so, again, everything isn't World War III in terms of the doctrine of separation either. 1 Corinthians 5:9 and following, I wrote in you in my letter not to associate with immoral people. And here, once again, the Corinthians had taken it and gone to an extreme with it. I did not at all mean the immoral people of this world or with the covetous or swindlers or idolaters, for then you'd have to go out of the world. But I actually wrote to you not to associate with any so-called brother if he's an immoral person, covetous, idolater, reviler, drunkard, or swindler, not even to eat with such a one. So if you've seen somebody get drunk, you can't eat with them? No, that's not what it's saying. Have you seen somebody steal? You can't eat with them. You know, have you seen somebody, be covetous on a particular occasion? It's saying if this is your lifestyle, if this is what you're all about, if this is the way you operate, your MO, we might say, every day, your modus operandi, you are covetous. It's all about money for you. Well, that's the kind of believer you don't want to hang around with. And then 2 Thessalonians 3, which deals with the other situation we were talking about, where you deal with the concept of aloofness rather than, and this is the believers that will not attempt to support themselves, that will not get disciplined, that will not work a regular job, and take care of their own financial responsibilities. If the believer doesn't do that, he puts himself into some dangerous territory. And so here he says, we command you to keep aloof from every brother who leads an unruly life and not according to the tradition which they received from us. For you yourselves know how you ought to follow our example, because we did not act in an undisciplined manner among you, nor did we eat anyone's bread without paying for it. But with labor and hardship, we kept working night and day so that we might not be a burden. And not that we had to, as he says. I had apostolic authority. I could have demanded that you support me, but we're setting an example. And as a model for you, that you might follow our example, verse 9. For even when we were with you, we used to give you this order. If anyone will not work, neither let him eat. Now, if we would enforce that in society, I guarantee you, people would work. No more food for you until you get a job. And so, and again, not only were they not working, on top of all of that, because of all the spare time they got, they're just flitting around here and there. They lead a very undisciplined lifestyle. It's constantly just chaos around them, and they're acting as busybodies, running around. They're involved in everything. They got to be in on everything. Yeah, ooh. No. Now, such persons we command and exhort. Some people want to solve a lot of their problems, just a good old-fashioned job. But, you know, we can't expect everybody to work, right? Yeah, we can. One, while none of us like to see others suffer, we must recognize that God uses this method to teach us and other believers lessons we need to learn and cultivate the graces of the Christian way of life, which deals, of course, Romans 5:3 there, deals with the principle of patience. And tribulation, testing, produces patience. People say, well, my niche is hard. Meh, so's mine. You know, I'm very unsympathetic. I got this doctrine down. I remember when Stuart told me, it looks like I might have to get a job. Wow, who would have thunk it? What are you looking for, sympathy? Well, it's in the dictionary between. I won't tell you the words it's between. But the reality is, guess what? God knows what he's doing. And some people need to have their niche hard. Let's face it. I mean, if you've thought about it much, and I have, one of the things I've recognized is over the years, I really do better on a short leash. If you give me too much slack, I'll probably get in trouble. Because I'm just that damn stupid sometimes. But I ain't the only one. Romans 5:3, and not only this, but we exult in our tribulations. No, we don't. Well, we're supposed to. We're supposed to be happy about the difficulties that we face, because knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance. And there's a chain of effect here. And perseverance brings proven character. And proven character, hope. A synonym for RSG3. So, and also you can see James 5:13. I want to try to wrap this up today. 6 results of failure. A, failure to properly deal with these types of issues may lead to catastrophic results in the life of the believer. B, failure to orient to this doctrine, as with any doctrine, can result in divine discipline in the life of the believer. One of the things is that people tend to want to be do-gooders. Oh, I just want to do good. Well, you've got to learn to minimize that in some ways and understand that that's not always what you need to be doing. There's a time and a place for doing good, but there's a time and a place not to lift a finger to help people. They need to do it. And one of the things that I've always stressed is personal responsibility. You can come for help. We don't have any problem with that. But you better make sure you've done everything you can do first. Because if you haven't fulfilled your responsibility, why would you ask other believers to sacrifice on your behalf? You haven't sacrificed. You haven't done what you were supposed to do. So why would you ask for help? So this is one of the things we enforce strongly, is that, yeah, we're here. You can have grace and we'll help you. But guess what? You better do everything that you're supposed to be doing too. And by the way, here's a list. Start on them. Get it. So again, one of the things, some believers come under discipline because some believers out here are under discipline. Here's believer A. They're under divine discipline because they're stupid and because they're blowing off certain principles of God's plan, and he's had enough and he's lowered the boom on them. Now believer B comes along like Big Bird. La, la, la. I see believer A has problems. They need help. I've got to automatically jump in and save them. You're going to come under their discipline now because you just involved yourself in a situation God didn't want you to. So, and one of the things that we'd always stress is you got to kind of be discerning a little bit. You can't just assume. Number one, always recognize whenever you hear a story that you're only hearing one side of the story. And in some cases, you're only hearing the spin on that story that that person wants you to hear. And it may not all be the fact. I've seen some people that really have a great ability to spin the fact. I mean, they should be spin doctors. They should be involved in politics because they can spin a story like you wouldn't believe. And you hear that and you think, oh, my God. And you get all wrapped around the axle and riled up. And then you find out later, oh, man, they didn't tell me the whole story. I mean, how many, that's happened to you, right? You've had that happen where somebody tells you something. You think you've got it all together. Your righteous indignation flares up. And then you find out later, there was one little fact that was left out. And you, that one little fact totally changed the whole thing. And you go off half-cocked looking like an idiot. And so one of the things is, don't be too quick to believe everything you hear. Because some of it may not be true. Some of it may be a flat-out lie, even. I've known believers to lie, believe it or not. And, you know, nobody here, of course, but believers in general, those bad believers out there that lie sometimes. Well, we've all lied, haven't we? We all try to make ourselves look better in the story. You know what I'm talking about. So, see, failure here. But anyway, don't get involved necessarily. Don't just assume you got to jump in. Just, you know, play it cool. Step back. Show a little discernment. Yeah. By the way, you know how many really emergencies I've seen in my life where I had to do something right that minute? I mean, it had to be done right that second. Not very many. I can't remember any, to be honest with you. Where something just had to be done, you know? Don't always assume that everything's got to be taken care of today. I don't assume that. And I wouldn't if I were you. And people come to you sometimes and act like, man, it's got to be done right now. It does. I can't wait. I can't think. I can't pray. And I'm not saying there aren't legitimate emergencies that do have to be handled right there. That's why you have the emergency room. But not everything is that. You know, I'll bet you there are people coming in the emergency room that really isn't an emergency. There's some people that are just hypos, I guess. You know, they like the attention or whatever, you know. So, and we all know that there are people out there, drug addicts, that go to the emergency room simply to get a prescription. And so, again, not everything's an emergency. And sometimes all you need to do is step back and say, take a deep breath, breathe, and, you know, we'll go on. We'll see here, failure on the part of the military during periods of warfare may result in that soldier or another soldier losing his life. Kill the enemy. That's your job. You're not there to think about it. You're not there to talk about it. You're not there to feel sorry for him. You're not there to sympathize with him. You're not there to question the war. You're not there to question why you're there. You're there to kill. 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 Now that, you know, not like in that Arlo Guthrie song. Yeah, that was a great deal. There was a guy, you know, there on the Group W bench. And they wanted to kill. They wanted to train people to kill. That's what soldiers are supposed to be. Trained killers. Now, that's what you want in your military. Well, not anymore, we don't. But we used to want that. D, for those in the justice system that fail to administer severe penalties toward the criminal element, not only jeopardizes the safety of the populace, it reinforces the mentality that there are no consequences for criminal activity. Ecclesiastes 8:11, one of my favorite all-time verses, deals with this failure on the part of the establishment chain of command and the sad results of it. Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men are given fully to do evil. So people see this, oh, I know O.J. is going to find that killer somewhere, someday. Where is that killer? He hasn't killed again, isn't that weird? You know, and apparently he just hated those two people for some reason. Well, guess what? A whole lot of people lost confidence in the justice system when he walked. And let me guess. You think Kobe will walk? Let's see. What other famous people do we know that walk? How many times has Robert Downey walked? Now, if that was me, they'd have shot me years ago. E, failure to suppress your normal feelings for your child and consistently discipline them will result in misery for the parent, Proverbs 10:1, and 19:13, discipline and potential disaster for the child. So one of the ways to become a really unhappy parent is don't discipline your kids. Just let them do what they want. Trust their judgment at all times. Because they got good judgment. You don't want to thwart their little psyches by, you know, disciplining them. The Proverbs of Solomon, a wise son makes his father glad. That's true. But a foolish son is a grief to his mother. And probably he's foolish, most likely. The mother gets most grief because she's probably the most responsible, unfortunately. Of course, we know where the buck stops in the authority chain, don't we? Stop with daddy-o. Proverbs 19:13, a foolish son is a destruction to his father. And the contentions of a wife are a constant dripping. I love that one. Drip, drip, drip. You know, it's like Chinese water torture sometimes. You know. And not to say that only women do that. Sometimes men can be like drip, drip, drip too. So don't just assume that it's only a wife. Women are more known for it, but that doesn't mean they're the only ones that do it. Proverbs 13:24 also, he who spares his rod hates his son. That's just that simple. But he who loves him disciplines him diligently. And 19:18. Discipline your son while there is hope. That hope is while he's young, trust me. It doesn't take him very long. You know, you can see the manifestations of the STA pretty early on. It isn't like a child has to be 2 or 3 or 4 before you see it. I mean, they can show it in that first year. You can see that little STA trying to manifest itself. So I was going to try to get through this today, but I'm not, so we're going to stop there with that, and we'll continue here Wednesday night. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit enlighten us in Christ's name. Amen. Yeah, we have class this week. Yes, next week.